Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast by radio amateurs with a focus on homebrew electronics. We get together on the internet to swap ideas about radio construction projects. Our website is www.soldersmoke.com. Please send feedback to soldersmoke, that's one word, @yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. Man, will you listen to that music? Thanks again to Mark Mode Johnson for providing us with that inspirational electronic beat there. Well done, Mark. Hey, it's the 25th of March. The time is 10:08 UTC. I'm all goofed up on the local time because we went to British Summertime this morning. So it's 11:08 local. I am still operating on UTC, and this is Solder Smoke 51. Yeah, I took a closer listen to Mark's music there, and especially like the bit about the K2 in the beginning. It's all very original. I was thinking that music is so original. The instruments are so original. Nothing begged, borrowed, or stolen in that particular track. We don't have to worry about copyrights at all there, Mark. Thanks very much. And we've been getting a lot of very positive feedback from Solder Smoker listeners around the world who like the new electronic tunes. And if anyone wants to get more details on how Mark put that music track together, just go to the gadgeteer.news website, and you'll see an entry there in which Mark describes exactly how the music was made and what instruments he used. All homebrew stuff. Homebrew music for a homebrew show. Fine business, Mark. Carrying on with our kind of inspirational opening theme here, I want to tell you guys about a truly inspirational bit of amateur radio video. I'm talking here about Amateur Logic TV episode number 12. If you haven't watched this yet, you should watch it now, because I'm telling you, it is really, really good. Jim, George, and Tommy, the home brewers from Mississippi, have put together a really outstanding show, and I enjoy every minute of it. I watched it over the course of a couple of days in the morning here, and not only is it filled with really good practical technical inspiration, but technical information, but it's also got sort of homebrew inspiration in there. Here I'm particularly referring to one comment that Jim made. It was at the beginning of his segment, and we see Jim there seated in front of his workbench, and he just makes a comment about some of the best things in life, and he just paused. He said, "A hot cup of coffee, being at the bench, yeah, these are among the best things." And, you know, I think you have to be a home brewer or a gadgeteer. You have to be one of us to understand that sentiment, but it definitely resonated with my LC circuits here, Jim, so thanks for that. Jim went on to provide a really interesting and useful segment on network tools, on simple things that you have, bits of software that you have in your computer already that you can use to kind of diagnose what's going on with your system and find out what's going on with the net. He went through the use of two commands, ping and traceroute, that are available that let you, as the names indicate, ping a website, see how long it takes your packets to get there and back, and also to trace a route and to see how your packets go over the internet to the distant location and back. I found both of them very, very interesting, and was immediately pinging and tracing routes all over the place. I didn't know where my web host was located until I used the trace route and found out from that program that it's, I believe, somewhere in Idaho. I did some pinging and saw how long it took packets to reach the other side of the world. I did some exploration on the issue of, do we have listeners in China? That was very interesting. So thanks to Jim for that nice segment. George came in with something that was really practical and addressed a problem that that all of us have had at one point or another, and that is these terrible, cheap, little breakable 9-volt clips for the 9-volt batteries. You know what I'm talking about. You buy these things in a packet of 10 or 20 at your local Radio Shack store or wherever, and they seem to last for somewhere in the area of about 2 weeks to a month before they fall apart, get loose, have the wires break off. Just not a lot of quality in there. Anyway, George comes up with a solution that's very practical, easy, effective, and has the benefit of possibly involving dangerous explosions, which is always, of course, a plus for homebrewers and gadgeteers. It's always nice to have that little element of homebrew, workshop, workbench danger. So be sure to wear your goggles, folks, when you try this one. I'm sure you all will. Then George and Tommy got back together and presented a project using the Basic Stamp mini computer. And in front of our eyes there on TV, built up a little Basic Stamp project that will that could control the rig and send CW. It was really great. It made me think that that's the kind of thing I need to build, because I have over the years built a few little beacon transmitters. The transmit part is the easy bit for kind of an analog guy like myself, but the difficult part, of course, for me is getting something to control and generate the CW for the beacon. And I have to admit that I've been using really clunky solutions, like dragging out old, huge 486 computers and using them to generate the beacon CW signal. This is obviously overkill, and the same function could be performed by a nice little Basic Stamp chip there. So thanks for the digital inspiration there, George and Tommy. And, you know, episode 12 for Amateur Logic TV was recorded, I think, in early to mid-January. It was recorded before our friend Mike was killed in the car accident. And it was very poignant for me that they read an email from Mike about one of the projects that they were working on. So it was, like I said, it was a poignant moment. And but it just it was good to hear the email there from Mike on episode number 12. Let's see, moving on. Another bit of inspiration, guys. I sit here in the morning, and when it's early morning for me, and I'm up here at my workbench with my cup of coffee, it's probably the start of the workday over there in India, where our friend Farhan is going to work. And we've communicated back and forth on Skype quite a bit, and so I kind of know when Farhan is getting to work, because I get one of these messages from Skype saying that Farhan is logged on. I usually don't bother him, because I know he's logging on at work and he's using Skype for work purposes. But it's it creates kind of a sense of community there. I can get kind of an electronic message when Farhan gets on the net. Occasionally I'll get a text message or a call from him. They're always welcome. And just this week I was sitting here and suddenly the little chime went off. And there was a chat or text message coming in from India, from Farhan, asking me if I had if I knew about the Pico Z. And I knew instantly what Farhan was talking about. Some of you guys will know what we're talking about here. And I sent a message back to Farhan saying that I was way ahead of him, that I was already a qualified Pico Z pilot. And that the fact that the both of us in different parts of the world had discovered the same little aviation toy was an indication that indeed we are on the same frequency. The Pico Z is a little tiny helicopter. It's a remote controlled helicopter. I don't think it's radio controlled. I think it's infrared controlled, but it's the same kind of thing. It's about the size of, well, it lands on the palm of your hand. It's made out of styrofoam. And it's supposedly the world's smallest remote control helicopter. We got one here for Christmas. Supposedly Billy got it, but I think I've got more hours on it than he does. But it's a great little toy, and you could fly it around the shack. It's just the kind of thing that you need there for when you're trying to get that moment of inspiration, when you can't figure out a problem, you need to take a break. The thing you should do then is just sort of back away from the bench, grab the infrared remote control, and launch that Pico Z on a flight around the workshop. Maybe buzz the cat, or see if you can land it up on the propeller of the ceiling fan. Something like that. This is the kind of thing that you need to have in the shack for those moments when you need ideas or you need to take a break from that amplifier that won't stop being an oscillator. You know what I mean. I have taken a video of the Pico Z, and you can see what we're talking about here. A guy in the States put together a very nice video of him and his children flying the Pico Z around their living room. Yeah, and he's a quite good pilot, I must add. If you go to the video page at Gadgeteer, at www.gadgeteer.us, scroll down to the video page, and you'll see near the top a video on the Pico Z. I've also put a link up there on the video page to Amateur Logic TV. So those of you who don't know how to find Jim and George and Tommy can find them very easily through the Gadgeteer.us video page. More inspiration. I got to tell you, this has been a week of inspiration here at M0HBR. I've seen this page before. I think some of you has probably seen this page before, but it's worth a revisit. I'm talking about Jeff Dam, WA7MLH's website. Jeff is a longtime home brewer, and he's somebody who's over the years has made really important contributions to the hobby, to home brewing. If you guys pull out your copy of Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur, for example, and you look through there, many of the projects that are featured, especially many of the DSB, the double sideband projects in there, were actually projects that were put together by Jeff. Jeff worked years ago with Wes, W7ZOI, and I think that they lived in the same town and collaborated on many projects. I have always found the pictures of Jeff's projects in Solid State Design truly inspirational, because unlike some of those kind of squeaky clean, antiseptic, very kind of orderly project photos that you find in the ARRL handbook and in other technical sources, Jeff's projects are always suitably and appropriately kind of uglied up. They're the kind of, especially in Solid State Design, they look like the kind of projects that we build, very Manhattan style, very dead bug construction, a lot of crazy glue and PC boards. You guys know what I'm talking about, and it's always been for me really great to see kind of real projects by real hams in Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur. Anyway, Jeff's website is truly inspirational. He's got great pictures in there of some of his projects. There's his spectrum analyzer that he's been building, and that he's built, and there's all kinds of great photos of the circuit boards and the sub-assemblies and the components and how they all went together. I must say, even his ugly construction, even when he's using ugly style construction, it looks really great, and I really wish I could get even close to building like that. The other really cool feature of Jeff's site is that he's added audio to it. So when you see the pictures of his projects there, there's a little icon off to the right, and you can click and you can hear the man himself describe the project, how he did it, how he built it. Great stuff. I have a link to Jeff's site. It's on the gadgeteer.news portion of www.gadgeteer.us. So if you go there, near the top of the news page, you can find the link to WA7MLH's very fine business website. What else? Let's see. I have also up on the Gadgeteer News site a link to an article entitled "Whatever Happened to Hobby Electronics?" I think you guys will like this one. It's interesting. It's about us. It's about home brewers. It's about tinkerers and gadgeteers and people who do the things that we do. Written by a guy with experience in amateur radio. I think you'll get a kick out of it. I think he may be overestimating our numbers, but that's okay. The thought, the thinking behind it, I think is very solid, very interesting. I occasionally check out the Usenet group, recradioamateur.homebrew. We don't use this thing enough. There's occasionally interesting and good messages there. There's also a lot of junk, a lot of rants and raves and all that kind of internet anger stuff, so you have to kind of approach it with some caution. But there's occasionally some good technical postings there, and I came across one this week that I thought you guys would get a kick out of. We have been talking about BFOs, about beat frequency oscillators, and Greg W. up there in Finland had sent in a message a couple shows back about how as a kid he had used a little AM broadcast band receiver as a BFO to listen to single sideband shortwave broadcasts going out of Western Australia. There was a posting in Rec Radio Amateur Homebrew this week sort of related to that. People were talking about their experiences as shortwave listeners as kids, and one of the posters mentioned something that I had never heard of. I'm sure some of you guys have heard about this trick, but it's a new one on me. Anyway, what he was doing is he had a little commercial. I think he had a Helicrafter shortwave receiver. And this particular shortwave receiver had, I guess it was its first IF. The first IF, the first intermediate frequency in the receiver, was at 1.6 megahertz. And I imagine after that they brought it down even lower. I like the Drake 2B. I think the second IF or the third IF. I think it's the third IF is at around 50 kilohertz, and that's how they were able to use LC filters to get the outstanding selectivity that the Drake 2B exhibits. Pardon the plug for the Drake 2B. I couldn't resist. But anyway, this guy's receiver had its first IF at 1.6 megahertz, and he was using it for shortwave listening. And as a kid, and this is, I think, really good inventiveness, he discovered that if he took a bit of wire and hooked it up in the area of the 1.6 megahertz IF frequency, in effect, that little receiver became also a very low power medium wave transmitter, taking whatever it was receiving on the shortwave bands and retransmitting it at 1.6 megahertz, which is of course receivable on your standard shortwave, AM broadcast band receiver. So what he would do is he would leave this thing up in his attic shack, tuned into whatever station he wanted to listen to, put the little short bit of wire antenna on there, and he would get enough radiation from this thing so that downstairs or anywhere in the house, he would just turn on an AM radio and tune up to the top around 1.6 megahertz and listen to whatever the receiver was receiving. I thought that was a pretty good trick, and I hadn't heard that one before. I've kind of performed similar functions with baby monitors, and left the baby monitor in the shack, and then walked around the house with the receiver, listening to 75 meter AM on the East Coast, or something like that. But the use of the 1.6 megahertz IF, so well, that's a new one and a good one. So I'm happy to share that with you guys. Let's see. I got a little bit of internet news. I think I have fixed the .rss problems that that Solder Smoke has been having. With the help of Simon, HB9DRV. Simon was is Mike's, the host for Mike's website, and one of the problems that we had was that the RSS file, which is basically just a file on a website that that the robots of services like iTunes and other podcast services search for and look for in order to be alerted to updates. For iTunes purposes, we had that file on Mike's server in Switzerland. And when Mike passed away, I just had no way of updating it. So I managed to, with the help of a guy at work, managed to locate the owner of Mike's web host. And that's Simon, HB9DRV in Switzerland, and sent Simon a message, and he very kindly offered to reroute requests. So now when iTunes looks for the RSS file for Solder Smoke, and they go to Mike's site, Switzerland, they're automatically redirected to my web host in Idaho, where the updated RSS file is sitting. So those of you who use iTunes now will find episodes automatically coming through your system and into your MP3 players, or into your iPods, excuse me. But I hope that works out, and thanks to Simon for helping us get over that that technical problem. I had on the video page, I had posted a link to a really funny video on the video page about two guys, I think in New York or New Jersey, who are VHF, UHF contest enthusiasts, and they built a little rover, quite a big rover van, and made a rock video, if you can imagine this, about their VHF, UHF contest experience as rovers. And I thought it was pretty clever, pretty well done, pretty funny. And you really got to take a look at this van. I mean, the antenna array, I mean, it's NASA like is all I can say. And it's really quite something. I posted a little comment on the YouTube site. So when you go there, scroll down and you'll see a comment from M0HBR. I won't repeat it on the show. It just doesn't seem appropriate, but I think you guys will get a kick out of the video and the comments. Yes, in the area of the net, I am still trying to get a better understanding of whether we have a significant number of listeners in China. I'd be delighted to learn that we do. And one of the reasons I think that we might is that when I look at the statistics on Solder Smoke available from my web host, I see a very significant number of hits each month from China. In fact, more hits from China than from Great Britain. China is like number three in the hit count. I also have noticed that if I scroll down and look at the pages that have linked to Solder Smoke and that have brought us hits, that, in other words, hits that have come to us through pages that are that have put links to Solder Smoke, there's a very important Chinese MP3 website on there. It's called Baidu, Baidu.com, and Baidu has been a bit controversial over copyright issues. I think they're working those issues out, but it seems to me that we might be listed on Baidu, and I'm not sure how Baidu works. I don't think it just refers listeners to the site, because even though we have large numbers of hits, the amount of megabytes downloaded to Chinese computers is really quite low. So I'm just trying to figure out what's going on there. And if anybody knows and can explain it, my interest is purely technical. I'm just trying to figure out how that works. And if we do have any listeners in China, please send me an email. I'd be delighted to hear from you. And we haven't had any feedback from China yet. And if we do have a large number of listeners, it'd be fun to hear from you guys. So send us an email if you get a chance. Okay. Well, let me just now move on to what's going on the workbench. I think everybody's probably getting sick of hearing about my adventures with the feedback amplifiers that I've been building. I'm spending far too much time in front of the computer and not enough in front of the real workbench and real soldering iron. But I've tried to improve in this area over the last few weeks, and I decided to actually do something with this little three-stage feedback amplifier that I've been designing. And originally had hooked up to it my ceramic resonator variable oscillator for around 14.3 megahertz. And I may go back to that eventually if I decide to turn this thing into the elements of a phone rig. But for some reason yesterday I had some CW urges come over me, and I built up a little variable crystal oscillator for 20 meters and hooked the variable crystal oscillator up into the feedback amplifier and could get about a half watt out of it. Looked fairly clean, and actually made an attempt to make some QSOs with this thing. It's all on the workbench. Literally, everything's pegged. All the circuit boards are pegged down to a piece of pine shelving, so it's extremely ugly. But it is putting out RF, and I made a few kind of half-hearted efforts to call stations with it yesterday, but conditions weren't really good, and nobody heard me. I even tried a coordinated QSO. I was chatting with Thomas, LA3PNA, via Skype yesterday. I told him about the project, and because he looks about short skip distance from me, he's up there around in the Oslo area, which might be real short skippish. Probably not. Probably inside the skip zone now that I think about it. But anyway, I couldn't resist giving it a go, as they say, and Thomas listened for me, but he couldn't hear me. So I'll be firing this thing up over the next few days, and I'll hopefully be able to report some contacts next week. One thing that's unusual about this is that the amplifiers are all running Class A, and they're all feedback amps. I notice that in almost every design for ham radio rigs, such as in the BitX 20, there are a number of stages with feedback. But then when they get to the final amplifier almost never employs feedback. And goes out to the... I'm always wondering why there is this need not to use feedback amps there in the final. It seems to me that you'd get the additional unconditional stability in the final if you use a little bit of feedback there. Of course, you're sacrificing gain, but wouldn't it be worth it to use some feedback there? The other unusual thing about my little transmitter is that all the stages are Class A, and certainly with CW transmitters, the final stage is almost always Class C, and for SSB rigs, it's almost always Class AB, but I've just kept it all in Class A just for experimental purposes. So the thing does get kind of hot. There's a lot of current going through it. But again, this is all just for experimentation purposes, and I'm keeping it in Class A for now. One of the problems I have with it is that the little variable crystal oscillator has a little bit too much output, and it's sort of pushing the limits of linearity of the final stage. So I think I'm going to have to go in there and insert some resistive pads between the oscillator and the first amplifier stage, just to bring the input to the first amplifier stage down to the level that I want it. It's a fun project. I've learned stuff with it, and who knows, it might actually produce a rig that gets on the air. Okay, it's the 24th of March.
Bye-bye now.
This is Band Sweep. Solder Smoke.
Come again?
On 17 meters.
It's the station, Yankee Papa Radio. Give it to me slowly, old man. Yankee Papa Radio, you're very weak with me, over.
And on the air, we're listening to one of the sharpest guys in ham radio. That's Mike, EAADQ.
Okay. Germany, Italy, 4, Yankee Papa Radio. You're just there, old man. Just about redeveloped. Just about a 5 millimeter movement here. Name is Mike. Mexico, Italy. I'm on the northwest coast of the island of Tenerife. Gulf, Italy, 4, Yankee Papa Radio. Echo Alpha 8. Echo Quebec, over.
I'm not even going to tune around, because when I get on 17 meters and I hear Mike, I leave the receiver tuned there. Mike and I spoke just about, it seemed like just about every couple of days when I was out in the Azores with CU2JL.
Yeah, I think you said, I got the name there, I think you said the county down coast, I'm not certain, but it sounded like the county down coast, so I just wonder what part of the coast you're on. Down Patrick, Kilkee, or whereabouts there, Warren Point, maybe down in the south, I don't know. But anyway, Des, nice to hear you. Just making readability 5 there. I have the preamp in, and you're still not moving the meters, so conditions possibly not all that good today. Running about 1 kilowatt here on the antenna, 6 element, log periodic. Gulf Italy 4, Yankee Papa Radio, Echo Alpha 8, Echo Quebec, over.
Anyway, Mike divides his time between Ireland and Tenerife in the Canary Islands, and a really, really interesting fellow. And one of my big regrets about being here in London is that I'm poorly situated to talk to Mike. I call him. He can hear me, but I feel bad about making him suffer with a really, really weak signal out of London. So
Roscommon originally, but my station, my Echo India station, is located in Galway. So whenever I'm up there, which is once a month, I'm operating out of Galway as well. There's Echo India 0, Charlie Lima. Okay, there. Well, thanks for that report. On 15 meters and 12 meters is open too. Okay,
Des, 17 is definitely up and down. I'm listening on the Drake 2B in the 2.1 kilohertz position. And like I said, not too many signals on 17 today, but there he is.
CQ, calling CQ on 17 meters. Recall Alpha 8, Echo Quebec calling. EAADQ, Echo Alpha 8, Echo Quebec, calling CQ on 17 meters and listening, over. CQ calling CQ on 17.
When I was out in the Azores with just 5 watts, I'd call them and we'd have a solid QSO every time. I guess I was assisted by all that salt water between us. And I had a clear shot of the horizon in just about every direction.
What is the call? Okay, well, you sound good. You sound very good. I'm running the same transmitter here, by the way, as you. I'm using a different receiver, receiving on the 9500 ICOM receiver. You have a nice setup there. You must be very pleased with that machine. I'm not running just the same power as you, but 750 watts here, and a smaller amplifier, and a 6 element log periodic. About 20 meters up there, so not just as a big a station there, but I don't know if you were on 15 meters or not earlier, or 12, but just to tell you that there's some very good PX amount on 15, and there was some very good PX yesterday in the northeast, in the beam northeast, there was Japan, China, Indonesia, coming in, at about 1,600 hours onwards, and 12 meters is also open at the moment there. My name is Mike, by the way. Cheers, old man. Nice to work you, and thanks very much for the call. Very best wishes. The Gulf, I just got the Gulf station. I bet somebody covered you up. You mean anything? Jeez, calling me there. But they should kill a what, Germany, London. I think you were the first one that got that came in there. And I'm not sure if it's a G4 or what, but I get that in a second. Very nice to hear you there. My name is Mike, Mexico, Italy, Kilowatt, Echo, and I'm on the northwest coast of the island. Conditions not too terribly good today. The band is not jumping up and down. So let's see how we do anyway. The name is Mike, and I'm on the northwest coast of the island of Tenerife. The station Kilowatt, Gulf Lima, I am not sure about the prefix. Echo Alpha 8, Echo Quebec, over.
Anyway, very, very happy to hear Mike here. Put him on Solder Smoke. 17 is one of my favorite bands, and I know it's one of Mike's favorite bands too. And I imagine that one of the reasons he's on 17 today is because it's a contest weekend on the other bands. I thought about doing a band sweep segment on 20 meters today using a double sideband homebrew receiver, but it was just very disheartening, and I didn't want to force you guys to listen to 5 or 10 minutes of CQ contest and 5-9 over and over. So we came here to the refuge, to 17 meters, the contest free territory, and that concludes this week's edition of Band Sweep. Time for Solder Smoke Mailbag. I must say that Moj Johnson's gong, I think, sounds even better than mine. Here, let's see. Mailbag this week. I mentioned Thomas, LA3PNA, a fellow home brewer over there in Norway, and I had asked him to let us know what projects he's working on. And he says he always has at least 4 or 5 projects on the table. At the moment, he's building a homebrew high-performance transceiver based on Cumbria Design's T1 kit. He gives the name of the company, www.cumbriadesigns.co.uk. He's also building a PA0FRI one-tube HF amplifier using an EL519 tube. He notes that sometimes you need more than 5 watts. I agree with you there, Thomas, although some of the QRP purists will be upset to hear us say that, but I think it's true. Thomas also has on the bench a W7ZOI power meter, something that I need. I need one of these. Mike was always telling me that I needed one, and at one point he offered to build me one, and I think I need one, so I'm gonna be putting one of those together. I'm very often dealing with very low power levels and trying to measure things, and as Wes always points out, the ability to measure is just key in all of this. So I think it's time for me to do a little bit better than the RF probe that and my very inaccurate oscilloscope that I've been using. So it's time for a W7ZOI power meter here. Thomas says that his just needs to be placed in a box. He's got a homebrew experimental FET Class A broadband HF amplifier. Excellent. I did the same kind of experimentations, and it was a good thing that I started out with a large bag of FET transistors, because I just destroyed them at a really frightening rate. So, and I often managed to burn my finger in the process. At one point, I had the figure or the surface features of a MTP3055V FET amplifier transistor burned into my thumb. You could tell if you're a true home brewer if you've got burn marks like that on your hands and fingers. Let's see. I'm also waiting on the Kanga boards for the W7 ZOI spectrum analyzer, and he's waiting for experimental methods in RF designs. And let's see. He says he's also taking a look at the BidX, and he's thinking about using it as a project for his ham group. So great, Thomas. Interesting projects. In yesterday's chat, I think Thomas told me that he has the Kanga boards for the spectrum analyzer. And man, I might be asking to borrow that thing when you get it finished, because we all, from time to time, need one. Let's see, more email. Got another nice message from. Let's see here. Get my papers in order. Let's see. Ah, yeah. From Pete. W6JFR. You'll recall that Pete was is the Elmer, the mentor for Dan at KB9JLO, whose inspirational email we read here on Solder Smoke a while back. And Pete comes in and talks a little bit about some of the projects that he's working on, a lot about the BidX20, and he's found the BidX20 to be a truly robust design, and he's having a lot of fun building it. In response to my column, my comments about the International Geophysical Year, Pete chimes in and says, "In 1956, I was in high school, and ham radio was a part of the IGY. You see, I knew it. I knew that my interest in this thing had something to do with the year that I was born." Says here, "I also listened to Sputnik on my national SW54, and it could be heard near the 15 meter band." Yep, I think they were transmitting right around 20 megahertz. What a trip! And Pete says that he loves the new theme music. He goes on, he talks about some of the projects he's working on. But one of the things I wanted to share with everybody here from Pete's note is kind of a trials and tribulation kind of thing. I know we have a lot of people who are new to home brewing and new to ham radio, and we certainly shouldn't give folks the impression that this is all easy and plug and play. It's not. There's a lot of suffering and tears and agony involved in building your own radios. It's all worth it, of course, but let's face it, it's no bed of roses out there, guys. Once you get those solder smoke fumes going in the shack, terrible things can happen. And Pete shares with us one of his tales of woes. He says, "One of the things I shared with Dan was that after having the radio working for about 2 months, I finally decided on an enclosure approach. I took my time in building the enclosure and great pains to align the national velvet vernier with the variable cap that had to be elevated off the bottom of the plate." National velvet. Yep, this guy's, his instincts are in the right place. "After doing all of that, I turned on the radio and it stopped working on receive. Since it is a bilateral circuit, many circuits are in common and could be eliminated as the possible problem. I could hear noises in the headphones, but no signals. Finally, I decided to bypass the volume control and wire directly from the preamp, the NE5534, to the audio amp, LM386. Well, it blew out my ears. So I thought it must be a bad pot, a bad potentiometer, a bad variable resistor. I wired in a new pot, and in the process of removing the old pot, found that as I had rerouted the original pot wiring, one of the wires got pinched under one of the small support posts for the variable capacitor. The top of the pot, which is connected to the output of the preamp, was completely grounded. Thus, I could hear hiss out of the audio stage, but no sound. So the lesson to Dan was to look for the not-so-obvious. I spent nearly 2 days tracking that down." Don't feel bad, Pete. We've all been there. We've all done that. We've all got stories like that. And it's great when you get them fixed, but it's not so great when you haven't got it fixed. So anyway, our sympathies, and thanks for sharing that dose of reality with us. See what else we got. We got a nice message here from Arv, K7HKL. Arv's involved in BidX20 work. And he says, great work on Solder Smoke. I got caught up with the last few editions while assembling one of the prototype BitX20 kits that will soon be available from Doug Hendricks, KI6DS. You are certainly correct as to PC board crowding being the cause of the RFPA instability. For the Doug Hendricks kit, Dan Talo, N7VE, has done a fine job of PCB designing and has also redesigned the new RFPA stages. Doug is putting the kits together and will have them available pretty much at his cost. Jim Cortez, K8IQY, and myself are assembling and testing the version 1.1 prototype PCBs. We now have them working. Jim's 2 days ago and mine today. It looks like 7 watts power output, maybe a bit more in some cases, and a very sensitive receiver. Well, fine business, Arv. Let's see. He says, I don't want to forget the other BitX20 kit sources. Sunil Lahan, VU3SUA, is working up a kit version of the BitX20 and should have his units available soon. In addition, Far Circuits, www.farcircuits.net, has a two-board PCB set for the BitX20, but you have to find your own parts. I think there are other kit and partial kits being made up as well, mostly in India. Yeah, Arv comes in. One correction for the Solder Smoke 50 comment on the BitX20. The original IF frequency was 10.0 MHz. This has caused some problems for U.S. hams who are located close to WWVB transmitters. But it is also a good receiver alignment tool. A number of BitX20 builders have used other frequencies for their versions. Jim, K8IQY, is using a set of 11 MHz crystals in his prototype build as a way for those U.S. hams with strong WWVB signals to avoid 10 MHz. I'm not sure if Doug's soon-to-be-available kits will have an IF frequency option, but we do know that 11 MHz works for those who may have WWVB problems. Versions of the BitX20 have been built for almost all ham bands from 6 meters to 160 meters, usually with excellent results. 17 meters seems to be a favorite alternative to 20-meter band construction. Changing the operating band usually just involves changing the VFO frequency and redesigning 2 band selection filters. Farhan even has a multi-band version of the BitX on his website, www.phonestack.com/Farhan. A number of BitX20 rigs have been built specifically for running PSK31 or similar digital modes. There are CW modifications, DDS versions, H&P Huff and Puff stabilized versions, and some with VXOs instead of VFOs. Most of the BitX group seem intent on further evolution of Farhan's excellent rig to see just how far we can take it. Hope this was of interest. 72 from Arv. Certainly was, Arv. Thanks for sharing that with us. And I know there's some real excitement about the BitX20 out there. It's a great rig, and man, I'm tempted. I have to build something here. We have a move coming up, guys. Though Solder Smoke is moving. It's not going to happen for another 4 or 5 months or so. But I can tell you that our new location will be in Rome, Italy. And I don't know if I should start any major projects until we get the shack and the workbench and all this huge collection of junk that I have around me transported about 900 miles to the southeast to beautiful Rome. But I'm tempted. I'm going to keep the project short until then. Nothing major until we get the relocation taken care of. It's going to be a bit of a hectic period. Anyway, I think that brings us to the end of Solder Smoke 51. I hope you guys have found this interesting and hopefully inspirational. Keep those emails coming in. I'd love to get them. Send them to soldersmoke@yahoo.com, and we'll try to get back to you as soon as we can. And I really appreciate all the feedback. 73 from London to the big group. This is M0HBR.